This is Amarins. Hello again, and welcome to episode 33. It's Tuesday, August 14. For the benefit of new listeners, my name is Arthur, and I'm a gay American who moved to New Zealand in 1995 to be with my partner, who's a Kiwi. This podcast is basically related to all that. You'll have noticed that there was no podcast on Friday. Now, there's no drama in that. I just had a lot of things to do that day, and time ran out. I don't normally record evenings or weekends, because that's time I spend with Nigel. And we had other things to do, so we couldn't record together either, by the way. So that meant that my first opportunity to record was Monday, and I decided I may as well wait until the normal Tuesday slot to carry on. There's a good chance that I won't have time to record this coming Friday either. We'll just have to wait and see. Actually, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I've been wondering if it's worth keeping the twice-weekly schedule. I'm wondering if maybe the sort of limited scope of this podcast makes more sense in weekly doses. What do you think? Obviously, I'll do what makes sense for me, but I'd really like to know what you'd prefer. By the time you hear this, I'll have added a poll to my blog, which is at amarins.blogspot.com, where you can choose what you'd like. It's completely anonymous, so even if you've never commented before, be sure to cast a vote so I know what you'd like. Now today, I'm going to go over a selection of recent news stories about or affecting New Zealand, and all of them have something to do with the U.S. or its influence on New Zealand, but mostly it's stories that probably aren't reported in other countries. That starts at the 2-minute, 3-second mark. Then I'll go into more detail about one of those stories at 8 minutes 55, and finally comments at 15 minutes 43 seconds. First up, there have been a couple stories recently about the American government's requirements for travelers entering the U.S. by air. First, there's this from Amy Goodman from the July 31st Democracy Now!
The European Union has agreed to cooperate with the United States on an airline security program that's been widely criticized by privacy groups. Under the agreement, airlines flying from Europe to the U.S. will be required to hand over detailed personal information on passengers. Depending on the circumstances, the information could include racial or ethnic origin, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, data about an individual's health, traveling partner, sexual orientation, and whether the passenger is a member of a labor union. Airlines will not be required to collect this information about passengers, but any such information that exists in their reservation system will be shared. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff praised the pact as an essential screening tool. Chertoff said such a system would have helped uncover many of the 9/11 hijackers. Jim Dempsey of the Center for Democracy and Technology said, quote, "This is part of a broader trend of the government building databases on the ordinary lawful activities of ordinary law-abiding people."
So let's recap. Chertoff says that this system would have helped uncover many of the 9/11 hijackers. Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten how many of the 9/11 hijackers were gay members of the Teamsters Union with asthma. Last week, Chertoff also announced new rules requiring airlines to send passenger information to the Department of Homeland Security 30 minutes before departure so they can order passengers off planes rather than force the planes to return mid-flight. Now, all of this is an issue for people outside of America who have to face far more rigorous and intrusive screening than Americans do. All foreigners entering the U.S. have to be fingerprinted and photographed, for example. Now, most put up with this being treated like a criminal because they understand America's caution. But the data required by the Bush administration is increasingly irrelevant to fighting terrorism, and it's often information that Americans would never allow the government to collect about them. There's some anecdotal evidence that it's already discouraging tourists from traveling to America, and it seems to me that reducing the already limited contact that Americans have with foreigners can't be a good thing. But meanwhile, here in New Zealand, the government is working on a near total revamp of immigration law, and it's surprisingly Bush-like for a centrist government. Mind you, much of the change is required by so-called international obligations, which mostly means dictates from the Bush administration. But some of it, I think, is pretty worrisome. The government will be allowed to use secret information to exclude foreigners without them ever being allowed to know what the allegations are, and that makes any defense impossible. Now, while this is commonly done in America under Bush's administration, it ignores common law dating back to Magna Carta, because the inability to face one's accusers means that foreigners won't be allowed proper due process. Now, the revamp will also require the photographing of returning New Zealanders to compare with the photo embedded in the microchip on New Zealand passports, and the idea is to see if the person is who they say they are, but it's a radical change for New Zealand. I should point out that any of the specific provisions may change or even be dropped from the final version of the bill. But speaking of treating innocent people like criminals, Parliament is also rewriting copyright laws to allow people to copy their CDs to their iPods or other MP3 players. See, unlike the US, New Zealand has never had a fair use assumption about recorded music, so format shifting, you know, loading a CD into iTunes, for example, was technically illegal. And at the moment, the only legal way to load music onto an iPod is to purchase it from a legitimate site online, like iTunes Music Store, for example. But the iTunes Music Store only opened in New Zealand late last year, and other services were incompatible with iPods. So I think it's safe to assume that people loaded their CDs onto their iPods. Now, the new law will make that legal, provided it's for personal use. However, people will be required to keep the actual CD, and copying borrowed or rented CDs or making copies for friends will be criminalized, pretty much as you'd expect, I suppose. Now, the truly bad part is that music companies will be allowed to opt out of giving permission to copy, meaning users will have to read the incredibly fine print on every CD they buy. And I'm pretty sure that people aren't going to do that. Also, DVD movies and television are specifically excluded, and one can only record and keep TV programs, for example, for a period that's no longer than is reasonably necessary for viewing at a more convenient time. That's stupid, and it's unlikely to be obeyed, no matter what the law says. I'd actually be curious to know what American law says about the same thing, because there may be restrictions on home recording that people just aren't aware of. Now, the main reason that there are these restrictions is that the media companies demand it. Due to the multinational nature of the entertainment industry now, there's not much that a small country like New Zealand can do to have a more open regime than the media companies will allow. And the only reason that Americans have a somewhat more open time right now is that the media companies have calculated that the economic impact from tightening control there would way outweigh the benefits. They don't feel those kinds of restrictions in the rest of the world, I guess. But in other news, New Zealand's jobless rate continues at record low levels, and that's according to the latest government statistics. The unemployment rate was 3.8% in the June quarter, and the portion of the working-age population that's either in work or actively seeking it hit a record 68.8%. However, due to the continuing financial panics on Wall Street and concerns over credit in the U.S., the New Zealand dollar has dropped in value much more quickly than expected, and that will likely lead to more expensive petrol, among other things. At about $1.53 per liter, petrol in New Zealand is currently selling at the equivalent of roughly $4.31 per U.S. gallon. Now, last week, a right-wing Christianist group organized a stunt in which people were asked to observe 3 minutes of silence in memory of a young girl who was recently abused to death. Now, while the incident of child abuse was horrific, the irony was that the Christianist group itself led the campaign against recently enacted law banning the smacking of children. Under the old law, parents could claim their beating of their children was reasonable force, and the cases were dismissed, even when it was pretty clear that it had crossed the line into assault. The new law removes that defense, but makes clear that the police are only to pursue real assault, not, you know, light smack across the bottom, for example. Nevertheless, the Christianist group opposed the law change and advocates a so-called loving smack. And that brings me to my main topic today, right-wing Christianists in New Zealand. An article in the Sunday Star Times newspaper this past weekend said that the main group behind that 3 minute of silence stunt plans on promoting so-called family values in the next election by focusing on targeting members of parliament who voted for civil unions, legalized prostitution, the ban on smacking children, and anything else that in their opinion is anti-family. Now, as I wrote in my blog, the group says marriage is only between one man and one woman, and every other type of family is illegitimate. It's against abortion, and also the vaccine to prevent cervical cancer because it may lead young women to immoral behavior. Apparently, their daughter's death is preferable to immoral behavior. So, are these people a real threat? Well, the Sunday Star Times article also reported that a poll they conducted found that 15% said they'd be likely to support a new party based on Christian moral values, and 6% claimed that they were almost certain to support such a party. Well, does that mean that New Zealand is about to be conquered by the radical right Christianists like America was? Well, no. Not a chance. And here's why. First, The article doesn't say what Christian moral values are. And that same phrase is used by the left to support social justice, care for the poor, gay rights, and lots of other issues. In fact, the first Labour Party Prime Minister, Michael Joseph Savage, described his party's then mostly socialist policies as applied Christianity. But even assuming that those respondents were all meaning right-wing Christian moral values, history suggests that they aren't at all likely to back such a party. In 1996, the right-wing Christianists combined forces but failed to win a single electorate seat and weren't even able to cross the 5% threshold, 5% of the nationwide popular vote, which is the minimum that's needed for representation in Parliament. The thing is, voters were afraid of wasting their vote on a party that couldn't possibly win government and that might not get into Parliament at all, as, in fact, it didn't. After 1996, right-wing Christianists have done even worse, and in 2005, a secretive right-wing Christianist group tried to influence the election by spending over $1 million in a smear campaign against the Labour and Green parties. And it was actually one of the factors that cost the Conservative National Party that election. Now, the current National Party leader is an agnostic who said that it's impossible to know if God exists, and he's steering his party clear of religious entanglements. Prime Minister Helen Clark of the Labour Party is also not religious. And this is a far cry from, say, Australia, where the right-wing Prime Minister John Howard has been tripping all over himself trying to win the votes of right-wing Christianists. In New Zealand, much of the right-wing Christianist influence comes from overseas, especially America. A large chunk of the money for the campaign against the law banning smacking came from American groups, like Focus on the Family, for example, which is, of course, a well-known American far-right extremist group. They also plowed money into a failed effort to overturn Canada's legalization of same-sex marriage. Even New Zealand's main TV preachers were trained in America, have affiliations with right-wing Christianist groups in America, or actually are American. All of which leads to some suspicion of these groups by ordinary New Zealanders, who are mostly fairly secular. Even among the religious, trying to force their beliefs on others would be unthinkable. So, at the moment, the far-right Christianists are more bluff and bluster than real threat. Even if they somehow manage to overcome everything and get into Parliament, they'll be vastly outnumbered by secularists of all types, including very probably more atheist members of Parliament than they'll have of their kind. Still, as Wendell Phillips famously said, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, so people like this will need to be watched here as anywhere else. As long as they restrict themselves to honest political discourse, I don't think anyone would challenge their right to be heard. But as Hubert Humphrey said, the right to be heard does not automatically include the right to be taken seriously. Now, you may have noticed I used the term Christianist. That's to make the distinction between the political agenda of Christians and their religious beliefs. That matters because Christians aren't the foe, Christianists are. There are many different kinds of Christianity, but a Christianist is one who uses some Christian beliefs to promote a secular political agenda, often with religious overtones, of course. Now, Christianists can be either leftist or rightist, which is why I usually use the phrase right-wing Christianists. Obviously, the loudest and most visible Christianists are on the right, usually promoting a theocracy, but they don't have a monopoly on either Christianity or Christianist political activity. I think it's important to label the far-right accurately and not smear all Christians, nor even all religious-based political activists, because of the activities of a few extremists. And finally, a bit of an antidote to the right. I've mentioned before that one of my favorite sites is called Slap Upside the Head, which is from Canada. The author, Mark, says he's combating bigotry the gayest way I know how. Well, last Monday, he wrote about a town council in Nova Scotia that refused to allow the gay pride flag to be flown at their city hall during Pride Week. The mayor, Bill Mills, linked gay people with pedophiles, and then he also said he didn't see the point of a pride flag. Mark responded in what I think was a brilliant mini-essay, so I thought I'd end this news review with two paragraphs from that essay, because Mark's words demand to be heard. He wrote, "My take is simple. Pride flags exist because pride is the opposite of shame, which is precisely how people like Mills would have us gays feel. The lifestyle I'm supposedly flaunting is, in reality, no different from anyone else's, but there's a lot I've had to put up with. Pride is a fitting symbol. I'm proud of having overcome the misinformation I was fed over the years about gay people. I'm proud of overcoming the personal struggle to accept who I am. And I'm especially proud of how I continue to overcome ignorant policymakers, lobbyists, journalists, individuals, and churches who don't hesitate to attack me at every opportunity. Raising the pride flag is not an endorsement of any particular lifestyle, and certainly not the lifestyle that Mayor Mills has chosen to assign to all of a diverse group. Rather, it's a gesture of dignity and recognition of a minority struggle that, if refused in this manner, reinforces the purpose of why that symbol exists. Mayor Mills may not care to see the pride flag 1 week a year, but I have to put up with discriminatory nonsense all the time. And I think that was very well said, Mark. Right. Now let's move on to the comments. And I want to start by going back to the comments from episode 30, which was the Tuesday talk with Yorkie, because there's been a new comment added to that, and it's from John Q. Public, who said, "I'm one of those who doesn't comment often, but I had to come back and tell you what an interesting and depressing episode this was. The guys having to almost twist themselves inside out in order to be together is so sad. It's great that they were able to do it, but what about the guys without the financial resources to move to another country? I don't have a lot of hope that things will change very quickly in this country, even post-Bush. It's good to hear about guys who have made it work." And I said, "You're absolutely right, John. The situation won't change very quickly, regardless of who the next president is. Moving to another country can be easier than it might seem, the cost of a plane ticket possibly the biggest expense. But the biggest problem for binational gay couples is when the non-American partner is from a country with laws as backward as America's are. What can they do apart from look for a safe country they can both emigrate to? The long-term solution, of course, is to change American law, including, probably, a total repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act. But that's unlikely to happen no matter who wins the White House and Congress in the next election. Which means that the burden falls back on the binational couple to find a solution that works for them. Until the law changes, the least we can all do is offer support and encouragement to them as they work through the issues." And the only thing I wanted to elaborate on is when I say that it's not going to change no matter who wins the White House and the Congress, there's a reason for that. First, we all know that the Republicans are all in favor of excluding gay people, and they certainly back the Defense of Marriage Act. But the Democrats have shown no inclination to change the law in any way, certainly not to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. So I'm not optimistic that there's going to be any changes no matter what happens in the next election. It's a more of a long-term situation. So in the meantime, I would say that we all just need to be more aware of the problems facing binational gay couples in America, and being understanding that sometimes it means that they do have to go to another country in order to be together. It's the way things are with the laws as they are. Until we vote the bastards out and put in people who will do the right thing, it's not going to change. Now, going on to episode 32, which was last Tuesday, and that was the episode More Expats with Dawn and Darren. Dawn wrote, "Yikes, well, aren't I chatty? Sorry I cut you off so many times. I completely blame Skype. Thanks for having us on. We clearly love talking about moving to this incredible country and how much better our lives are here." And I said, "You didn't cut me off. It was Skype." There were actually a couple points where the delay was far worse, but I edited those out. "Thanks for being on. We'll have to do it again. Minus the Skype problems, of course." And I did actually have to rearrange things a little bit to make it work in that episode, but did the best I could under the circumstances. And Archer said, "Don't you hate when Skype screws up? It's funny how great the connection is when you're on my group shows, but you can't get a good connection in your own country. That sucks. Fun learning about Dawn and Darren and their move to New Zealand. Again, it makes me want to move there." And I said, "I was thinking the same thing. I can use Skype to talk to the U.S. easier than the capital of New Zealand." I think it wasn't all about the connection, though, and that there were a few issues going on. I'll work on resolving them for the future. There's plenty of room in New Zealand for you and the boyfriend, Archer. And, of course, there is. The more, the merrier. And our laws, of course, are much more tolerant and accepting than those of the U.S. are, as we all know. The only other thing I wanted to mention today was that we'd put in this electric inverter heat pump system, and I had no idea how much more it was going to cost. Well, we've gotten our first electricity bill for a full month since we've put the system in, and it increased our power bill by approximately $35 or $40 a month, for the month. And that compares to, in the height of winter, an extra $400 for gas. That's on top of power, of course. So to get 90% knocked off, we think that's pretty good. We're pretty happy with that. And it actually wouldn't have been that big, except that we've had a lot of rainy weather lately, and I've had to dry clothes in the dryer a lot rather than hanging them out to dry. And of course, we've been running the heated floor in the main bathroom for Jake, which we normally don't run. We only run that if we're having guests over. So we're using a bit more power than we would normally. And so really, the inverter system hasn't added much at all. And that is it for this week. Be sure to leave a comment on my blog, amrins.blogspot.com, or send an email to me at amrins@yahoo.com. And be sure to take part in the poll on what you would like to see happen with the podcast in terms of frequency and so on. I mean, as I say, I'll do what works for me, but I still would really like to know what you personally would like to see happen. So leave a comment, send an email, and take part in the poll. That's it for today, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. I'm